Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by contributors from community radio stations across Canada. This episode of Groundwire was produced at CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on occupied Anishinaabe Akin, homeland of the Métis Nation and the historical territory of the Nahiawak and the Nakota. My name is Susan Hubert. On this episode of Groundwire,
I mean, Chief Bannon is the architect of the Muslim ban.
As soon as 2015, people on welfare can no longer leave the province for more than 7 consecutive days.
We are contributing to serious human rights violations in the Americas, including Honduras, through Canadian mining companies.
But first, here are our headlines. Our first headline comes from radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on occupied Anishinaabe Akin, homeland of the Métis Nation and the historical territory of the Nahiawak and the Nakota.
The Ontario-based company Claim Post Resources intends to extract a staggering 26 million tons of fine sand from a site 200 kilometers north of Winnipeg over an 8.5 to 18-year period for use in hydraulic fracturing operations elsewhere across North America. If approved, the frac sand mining operation would be among the biggest in North America. Given the scope of the project, Don Sullivan, a former director of the Boreal Forest Network, argues that consultations with the nearby community of Hollow Water First Nation, as well as environmental impact assessments at both provincial and federal levels of government, need to be conducted.
A project of this size and this scope needs to be reviewed thoroughly by an independent agency that can look at both not only the benefits, but also the impacts, so that, you know, these impacts can be dealt with and mitigated. And the only process currently available to Canadians and Manitobans is a joint federal-provincial environmental review process that's public and transparent.
Don Sullivan has started an online petition at change.org calling for a joint federal-provincial environmental panel review process of the frac sand mining operation. Interested listeners can find a link to the petition by scrolling down the Facebook page for the Boreal Action Project. This is CKUW's Michael Welch for Groundwire.
Our next headline, also from Michael Welch of CKUW, concerns a solidarity action at Parliament Hill in support of Labrador land protectors fighting a major hydroelectric damming project along the Grand Churchill River.
On Monday, October 29th, 15 people were arrested for attempting to breach the barricade erected at Parliament Hill to block access to the House of Commons. They claimed their peaceful act of civil disobedience was aimed at confronting parliamentarians with the pictures and stories of the Indigenous people whose lives and livelihoods were compromised by the Muskrat Falls hydroelectric megaproject on the Grand Churchill River in Labrador. Elder Rita Monias from the northern Manitoba community of Pimichikamak Cree Nation was one of the people arrested. She explained that her community had been ravaged by 40 years of flooding impacts from Manitoba Hydro's operations and could therefore relate to what communities affected by the Muskrat Fall project were facing.
These developments contribute to cultural genocide because it takes our economy, our livelihood, livelihoods away from us.
Rita remained defiant in the face of the police presence that greeted her at Parliament Hill. She recalls her most memorable moment from the incident.
We all smiled. We were all happy. People will at least know that what happened to us, you know, the endeavor of talking to the Prime Minister and the ministers was there, but we were rejected. That's totally okay because that is exactly what governments are doing to people anyway.
For more information, check out the Facebook page for the Labrador Land Protectors.
Our final headline comes from Catherine Fisher of CJLY 93.5 FM on Sinaixt Traditional Territory.
On November 1st, the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives released a report tracking the growing reliance on contract jobs at Canadian universities. This report is the first ever snapshot of the prevalence of university contract jobs, where they're located, and what departments are most likely to offer contract work instead of permanent secure academic appointments. Once among the most secure professions in the country, by 2016-17, contract jobs in the university sector accounted for the majority of all university faculty appointments, according to data obtained through Freedom of Information requests to all 78 publicly funded Canadian universities. The CCPA's findings indicate that a reliance on contract faculty is a foundational part of Canada's post-secondary system and has been for at least a decade. Other findings include that, among contract faculty, part-time appointments predominate, accounting for nearly 80% of all contract appointments in 2016-17. There are significant differences in universities' reliance on contract faculty by province. Quebec relies on contract faculty more than any other province. Ontario and BC also have high rates of contract appointments. Surveys suggest that a majority of contract faculty are women. Between one-half to two-thirds of contract faculty have a PhD, and the majority have been teaching on contracts for 5 years or more. The CCPA's report, called Contract U, was authored by Chandra Pasma and Erica Shaker. It makes three recommendations to address the problem of precarity at Canadian universities: the need for better data collection, the need to address inadequate public funding, and stronger labor protections.
The report is available at www.policyalternatives.ca/publications/reports/contract-U. Thanks to Catherine and CJLY for that headline. That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this. Whenever you start to glow, so much better than the useless moons that we sometimes know. And I feel right when you remind me. Yo, fam, you just heard Glow by the Lytics from their 2018 album Float On. You are listening to Groundwire Community Radio News, available online at www.groundwirenews.ca. Now it's time for our feature stories. Our first feature comes from Michael Welch at CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe Akin, homeland of the Métis Nation, and the historical territory of the Nahiawak and the Nakota.
On Friday, November 2nd, hundreds of people descended on Roy Thompson Hall in Toronto to protest a speaking appearance by the controversial former White House strategist and head of Breitbart News, Steve Bannon. Hundreds of police were on hand to repel the protesters, and witnesses claim the officers used excessive force in protecting a man many feel should have been denied a platform in Canada. Radio station CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, on the unceded traditional territory of the Kanien'kehá:ka, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, interviewed Maya Meneses, an organizer with No One Is Illegal Toronto, about the group's objection to Bannon's talk in Toronto and the coalition that had assembled to contest the event.
I mean, just in the last, I think, 2 months or so in Toronto, there has been multiple white nationalist rallies where people came into the street, where white supremacists, white nationalists, and neo-Nazis in Nazi gear came into Toronto streets with the intent to fight people. Like, this is not a drill. We had, for example, there was another instance in Toronto where a hotel that was housing refugees and migrants was actually set on fire. Like, these are hate crimes that are escalating. They're becoming so common that they flip through the news on a regular basis, and it happens again, and then we're shocked. Like, we're deeply concerned because we have seen and continue to see the real-life consequences of this hyper-normalization. So, of course, yeah, we're worried. And more than worried, we're scared. And we're angry, and we want to do something about it. I mean, Steve Bannon is the architect of the Muslim ban. Steve Bannon was also a massive reason why migrant children were kept in literal cages and in prison-like conditions and separated from their families. Like, these are the real policy implications of what he's talking about. So to say that, you know, we want to understand more about what Steve Bannon represents is ridiculous.
A number of people were arrested for their involvement in trying to disrupt Friday's debate between Bannon and the former speechwriter for President George W. Bush, David Frum, on the topic of the future of populism in politics. One of those arrested was Rachel Small, an organizer with the Council of Canadians. In an interview for radio station CKUW, Rachel details what she observed of the actions of the police against her and her fellow activists.
I was tackled to the ground by a few cops, and yeah, and processed and arrested and didn't suffer any significant injuries. The person who was arrested beside me was punched in the face by a cop, has a chipped tooth, a black eye, a concussion, and is dealing with those serious injuries right now. Other people in the rally crowd were pepper sprayed very close range in the face and were being treated by community medics at the same time as police were attempting to take those supplies away from those medics. I didn't see that personally, but it sounds like it was a really, really tough situation trying to treat people who were in agony from being pepper sprayed in their eyes while tussling with the police who are trying to take away your alkaline solution. Other people were quite seriously hurt in the process of being arrested. Multiple people were hit with batons. Someone has suffered a very serious concussion. Other people were left in police vans for upwards of 5 hours. And anyone who's been in police van knows that they're not temperature regulated at all. So to be outside in November in a police van for 5 hours is a really terrible and scary situation. So while the event itself did take place, as you said, I think it was an opportunity for the City of Toronto to make an extremely powerful statement that this kind of hate is not welcome in our city. I don't know when I've last seen that many people come together to send such a strong message, as I said, of love for fellow community members and of banding together in solidarity against people spewing white supremacist and fascist ideology.
From downtown Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe-Gakin, the homeland of the Métis Nation and the traditional territory of the Nahiowak and the Nakota, this has been CKW's Michael Welch for Groundwire.
Our next feature comes from CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on the unceded traditional territory of the Kanien Kahaka, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Montreal-based nonprofit organization Project Genesis is calling on Quebec Minister Jean Boulet, who is responsible for social assistance and welfare, to address poverty in the province. According to the organization, one of every seven people live in poverty in Quebec, including over 200,000 children. Project Genesis is calling on the new government, Coalition Avenir Quebec, to implement concrete action towards reducing poverty. CKUT reporter Mohamed Imran has more on the story.
Attack poverty, not the poor, a slogan chanted loudly by the protester in front of the Minister Jean Boulet office in Victoria Square, Montreal, this Tuesday. The protest was organized by the concerned community members, People on Welfare, and Project Genesis, a non-for-profit organization. Speaking to the protest, Sheetal Patek, community organizer of the Project Genesis, stresses the government to end punitive policies and provide maximum relief to people on welfare.
So we're here to say enough is enough. These regressive policies must be taken back. These policies, what they do is they attack people instead of attacking the real causes of poverty. We're here to say to Minister Boulet, the new minister responsible for welfare, Jean Boulet, that he has to fight poverty and not the people who are living it. We will come back over and over as long as we have to make sure that the rights of people on welfare are respected. Because the rights of people on welfare are our rights. The government itself is imposing impossible budgets on people who are on welfare. And on top of that, they have many ways to cut in this small check. So for example, in such a context where the welfare check is already so low and people do get cut all the time, it is unbelievable that the last two governments have opted to cut over and over in this program. 2013, the Marois government removed people who are from 55 to 58 years old from the category of temporary limitations to work, effectively removing $134 from their check. So people who, couples who had children under five were also removed from this category, which meant a cut of $231 per month per household. In 2014, the Couillard government cut the $500 that was available as their return. return to work supplement for people who are on welfare and who found a job. So the list is very long. Also, as soon as 2015, people on welfare can no longer leave the province for more than 7 consecutive days. Also in the same year, $125 were taken from many people's checks who had roommates because the part of the rent paid by the roommate is considered income for the person on welfare, even if they never saw this money themselves. In 2016, the Couillard government again introduced the program Objectif Emploi, which led to historic cuts to the welfare check. That means that today, somebody on welfare, their check can be cut down to $324 per month.
Ariel Morial, a welfare recipient, also spoke to the occasion and explained the difficulties associated with the lives of people on welfare.
Throughout my life, I've been on all three levels of welfare. So that's people who are able to work, people with temporary limitations, and people with severe and permanent limitations. And I can tell you that, unfortunately, there is really no difference between them. Despite the past government's rhetorics about the worthy poor and the unworthy poor, there are rules and restrictions that affect us and make us and stress us out and make our life difficult, regardless of whether you're able to work, temporarily not able to work, or permanently not able to work. I am constantly worried about having my check cut, being accused of fraud, and not having the right paperwork in time, and running around, despite the fact that I'm sick. I don't know if you can see it, but this is an exhausting day for me, but I'm here because it's important. I'd like to blame them for the reason why the tax burden of the middle class and the working class is so huge, but the reality is that there are people who are being supported by the taxpayer, and they're in a major fashion, people who are undeserving, and that's not welfare recipients who are going through a rough time. This is the billionaire class in Quebec who receives corporate subsidies, tax cuts, and who use the loopholes in the government to avoid and evade taxation. And these are the people that we should be taking aim at. And if we did make sure that these people pay their taxes and stopped using public coffers as their own private piggy bank, we would have money for everyone and the tax burden would be reduced.
The protest ended with a demand from the government to devise policies to help people out of the difficult situation and not punish them. Mohammed Imran for CKUT, Montreal.
A Central American migrant caravan is generating a lot of attention in the midst of the U.S. midterm election campaign. Billy Pierre, a West Coast producer with the Media Co-op, brings us this timely story about the underreported role played by Canadian companies in creating the situation, which is seeing over 7,000 people from Honduras and Guatemala migrating towards the U.S.-Mexico border.
Hi, my name is Billy Pierre, and I'm affiliated with Media Co-op. Currently, there's a refugee migrant caravan that began in Honduras in mid-October that's on its way to cross the Mexican-U.S. border. It's grown to over 7,000 people from Honduras and neighboring countries and is currently crossing Mexico. While Canada has monopoly over mining in Honduras, these important facts have not been examined in mainstream media. Today, we'll be hearing from activists linked to Canada and Central America who will provide us with a closer perspective on the impacts Canadian mines is having on Honduras. Luis Diaz, a migrant rights activist living on unceded Silex territory in the Okanagan Valley, will give us a brief glimpse on historic factors that contributed to the present state of Honduras.
Since mid-October, there's been wide international news coverage of a migrant caravan. The focus, however, has been mainly on President Donald Trump's incendiary comments regarding the caravan and how he sent 5,000 U.S. soldiers to guard the U.S.-Mexico border. There is, however, little to no mention of Canada's economic relations with Honduras. In 1998, Hurricane Mitch struck Central America, and in Honduras caused the death of 11,000 people and $3 billion in damages. In the aftermath, Canada offered the Honduran government $100 million U.S. dollars over 4 years for reconstruction projects. Part of this proposal included the introduction of 40 Canadian mining companies into Honduras for investment purposes. At this time, Canadian and U.S. interests were integral in rewriting the General Mining Law. José Manuel Zelaya was elected in 2005, and with strong pressure from social movements, he canceled all future mining concessions and called for a ban on open-pit mining and the use of cyanide. Mere months before the 2009 coup, Zelaya's government was in the process of drafting a new mining bill. What part did these reforms or bills play in the eventual coup?
Up next, I'll be interviewing Jackie McVicker. Jackie McVicker has accompanied human rights social movements and land protectors in Central America for more than 10 years.
I understand you've been working in mining-affected communities in Central America for many years now. Could you give us an idea of what kind of work you've been involved with in Honduras?
My role as an activist and organizer on the East Coast working with Breaking the Silence was to try and educate Canadians about the different ways that we are contributing to serious human rights violations in the Americas, including Honduras, through Canadian mining companies. We do that in a number of ways as individual shareholders in companies and banks that then invest in these companies. We also do it through the Canadian Pension Plan, which invests hundreds of millions of dollars in mining companies.
What changes have you seen in your time in Honduras on a community level?
Since the 2009 coup d'etat in Honduras, Canada has played an important role by not denouncing the really serious situation that people are facing due to increased militarization and impunity and corruption in Honduras.
Has the strategy of community organizers changed in this time?
Many people, because they're criminalized, because they're targeted, they're kidnapped, they're extremely vulnerable as community leaders, and that makes it hard to organize because of the fear that you have, and it's real fear that you will be targeted and potentially killed.
Berta Cáceres has become a powerful symbol and martyr for land defenders around the world. What is the most important lesson we can learn from her life of resistance?
Berta became a legacy, a martyr, because people connected to her. They identified with her struggle because it's everybody's struggle. It's my struggle. I didn't know Berta Cáceres. But the morning I found out she died, I mourned deeply her loss, because what Berta did and what she continues to do even now in her death is make us all be more conscious of the type of world we're being part of and the type of world that we're creating.
What should the international community know about Canadian mining in Honduras and the current refugee migrant caravan?
The migrant caravan is a caravan that is showing us that the economic model, the extractivist model, this model that is pushed through free trade agreements and economic interests for extreme exploitation, whether it be of human beings or of the earth, it is not a model that leads to dignity. It's not a model that leads to an end of poverty. On the contrary, it leads to violence, it leads to eviction, and the migrant caravan is a reflection of what's happening here.
We now have a better understanding of Canada's significant impacts on exploiting and displacing communities in Honduras, and we can start to question if or what responsibility Canada has for the well-being of the people on the refugee migrant caravan and for the well-being of their communities back home.
Mama.
That report was put together by Billy Pierre of the Media Co-op with the assistance of CFRO 100.5 FM from the heart of the downtown east side of Vancouver on unceded Coast Salish territory. Background music was by Ermin Etwal.
A whole of my songs are stolen, and a whole of my poems are broken, and a whole of my lines were borrowed but never returned, though I always yearn to sing you back your sorrow.
You just heard Mockingbirds by Bartley Knives. Now it's time for our community radio report. Radio station CFUV, located in Victoria on the unceded territories of Lekwungen and St. Rossan-speaking peoples, specifically the Songhees and the Wasanich nations, is embarking on an exciting spoken word project called Play on Words. funded by grants from the BC Gaming Commission and from the Community Radio Fund of Canada, Play on Words highlights experimentation, sound art, and a narrative fiction story, and has been inviting emerging and established Indigenous and people of color writers, artists, and poets, filmmakers, and researchers to submit one-hour narrative fiction story pitches for the upcoming second season. Groundwire recently got in touch with two of the people involved in the project.
My name is Katie Sage. I'm the program director at CFUV.
And my name is Estraven Lupino-Smith, and I'm the producer for the Play on Words podcast. So we're looking at experimental sound and experimental music, soundscapes, different kinds of playing around with sound design, and then also looking at kind of like experimental narratives, I guess. So I said not narratives, but looking at different ways to communicate information without the more standard documentary and like segment format that you'll see with many podcasts.
CFUV's mission and mandate is to basically highlight and elevate and amplify underrepresented and marginalized voices in specifically within the Canadian media landscape. And that comes into play with genres and with folks with varying identities, whether it's they're marginalized by gender or race or class or whatever.
As far as the narrative fiction part, we do have a special, I think the funding also came through the gaming grant, and that's to create an original piece of writing, narrative fiction ideally, that is to be contributed by an Indigenous person or person of color, and we'll be going through a whole process of the call is already out for a pitch for that piece. And then there'll be a bunch of support for that person in creating the actual on-air or recorded drama for that. So it'll be auditioning voice actors and getting a lot of help with production and understanding how to take a piece of writing and make it into a solid piece for a radio drama type of thing.
So the debut of the first season of Plan Words was happened in the springtime of 2018. There was so many volunteers that came out of the woodwork, people who were women and non-binary who wanted to be involved in that project, and I thought that was really interesting.
The first episode for this season is going to be ready near the end of this month. It's going to be a really fun show because we're looking at ultrasonic sounds, sounds from outer space, sounds from the ocean. And I feel like that's something that might not normally come up if we're thinking about radio programming. And even if we were thinking about experimental music or something like that.
We expect to have all 8 episodes completed by the end of May. And then we're hoping to launch between June and July of 2019. It'll be Mondays, 11 to noon, will be when we're broadcasting them.
Thanks to Michael Welch of CKUW 95.9 FM for filing that report. That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced at CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on occupied Anishinaabe Akin, homeland of the Métis Nation and the historical territory of the Nahiawak and the Nakota. Headlines this week were written by Michael Welch and Catherine Fisher. Features were provided by Michael Welch, Muhammad Imran, Ali Sirwa, and Billy Pierre. Many thanks as well to Galma Hadavan and the CKUT News Collective for their contributions. Music this week was by Bartley Knives and The Lytics. I have been your host, Susan Hubert from CKUW. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station, or download at groundwirenews.ca. Thanks for tuning in.